You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, the Elizabeth Kingia bacterial outbreak last year in Wisconsin sickened more than 60 people, and 18 people died from the infection. We'll learn about an international effort to solve the mystery behind that disease.
Yesterday, David Rank, the United States' top diplomat in China, announced his resignation. According to reports, his departure came after President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement.
Rank's departure isn't the only sign of friction between key U.S. diplomats and the White House. The president's tweets about London's mayor and then about Qatar and other Middle Eastern countries may further complicate already tense U.S. foreign relations.
Arshad Mohammed joins us now. He's the diplomatic correspondent for Reuters. Arshad, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be here.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the context behind David Rank's departure?
Well, it's a very surprising thing for somebody who's been an American diplomat for as long as he had been, more than 20 years, to resign over policy. As you said in your intro, what our sources have told us is that he felt that he could not defend President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. He called a town hall meeting at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing yesterday, announced to the staff that he had decided to leave for this reason. And we're told that as soon as the administration in Washington found out about it, he was asked to leave immediately. To have an American diplomat pull out of their job like that is very, very rare.
And diplomats are, by nature of the job, they are nonpartisan, correct?
Absolutely. I've covered the State Department for more than, it's almost 15 years now. I don't know what are the political views of the vast majority of the diplomats that I've dealt with. Most of them take it as a point of pride that they're not going to tell you whether they're a Democrat or a Republican. A number of them that I've actually talked to about this over the years say they're independent. That's deliberate. Their purpose is to serve whoever is the president who happens to be in power, and they take that as really an article of faith in their profession.
David Rank held a lot of stature in his post as his top diplomat. What was the state of relations between the U.S. and China when he made that exit, and do you see his departure changing that balance?
You know, I don't know that his departure is going to change the overall balance of relations, because that is set by matters that are way, way above his head. The nature of U.S. relations with China has really been on a roller coaster over the last 6 months or so. Some of the things that President-elect Trump did during the transition, for example, taking a phone call from the president of Taiwan, upset the Chinese mightily. Since then, however, President Trump has hosted the Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago. He's made a much greater effort to try to get along better with the Chinese, the climate decision notwithstanding. And so relations are on a more kind of steady keel now than they were, say, or than they looked to be 6 months ago. But I think someone like Mr. Rank's departure is not really going to affect the broader picture.
And are you seeing echoes of that kind of tension between other top diplomats around the world, the State Department, and the White House at this point in time?
It's clear that there's tension. On a whole host of issues, American diplomats say privately that they find it very hard to defend positions that the administration, the current administration, has taken. Probably the most vivid demonstration of that was a letter of protest that was written by roughly 1,000 American diplomats and other State Department officials protesting against the original travel ban that President Trump sought to impose on citizens of seven mostly Muslim-majority countries in January. Those kinds of protest letters are rare. They're usually signed by one or two or a handful or maybe a dozen people. And for 1,000 people to say we're opposed to this is a really powerful signal. I spoke to a former senior diplomat yesterday who said that the way he sees it is that the State Department, in a way, seems to have taken against President Trump, and that there is almost a kind of pathology now where almost regardless of the positions that the White House adopts, there's a lot of mistrust on the part, on both sides, really, on the part of the diplomats on the one hand, and on the part of the White House on the other.
Can you explain a little more what you mean by taken against? How has that played out?
Well, I think it gets played out in a variety of ways. I think that there is a propensity on the part of the State Department officials, or some of them, to kind of look at anything the president does and be prone to criticizing it. You know, one of the things that you mentioned in your intro that's topical today is what is the U.S. government's position on the half dozen or so Arab nations that have cut diplomatic relations with Qatar. Yesterday, I talked to a bunch of current and former diplomats, and they all said Qatar is too important a country to be isolated this way. We need them militarily. We need them diplomatically. The United States is going to work quietly to try to patch things up here. Today, President Trump put out a tweet that in some ways almost seemed to be taking credit for the decision by some of these Arab nations, Saudi Arabia and others, to sever ties. That shows a disconnect, or it would suggest a disconnect, between the rank-and-file diplomats and the White House. And that leads the ordinary State Department people trying to figure out, well, what is our policy, and do we agree with, normally the policy is whatever the president says, do we agree with that policy? And if we don't agree with that policy, well, what are we doing here? Can we defend that? And Mr. Rank apparently decided that he couldn't defend the president's policy, and that's why he decided to retire.
Arshad Mohammed is with us now. He's Reuters diplomatic correspondent, joining us to look at tensions between diplomatic officials and the White House. And Arshad, the interim ambassador to Britain, Lewis Lukens, tweeted his support recently of London. London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, and a day later, President Trump had this fight with the mayor on Twitter. So looking again at the jobs that ambassadors and diplomats may do to be a mouthpiece for the United States, to smooth things over, to put things into context, is there a simple sort of the job is getting more difficult factor?
You know, I think there's no question but that the job is getting more difficult. I may be mistaken, but I thought the chronology was different. I thought that...
Yeah, I think I misspoke. Thank you.
No worries. So the president issued his tweet kind of taking out of context something that the mayor of London had said. And subsequently, later in the day, the U.S. chargé d'affaires, the top diplomat, Lou Lukens, essentially supported the chargé. And, you know, what Ambassador Lukens did, he is an ambassador, is kind of standard operating procedure. You know, a country suffers a tragedy or is victim of a violence of this sort, and you try to stick with them and show your solidarity. And in any other era, what he did would have seemed completely normal, natural, unexceptional, typical. What's different here is that the president manifests his views of things through his Twitter account, and in the case of that tweet, it's been widely viewed as his criticism of the mayor of London was misconstruing what the mayor had said. You know, the mayor said you're going to see a heavier police presence. Don't be alarmed by that. The police are there to protect you, and that's why you're going to see it. The president suggested that the mayor had said don't be alarmed, even though we've just had this attack. So, you know, I wrote a story about 6 months ago where internally a State Department official asked on an internal message board, what do we do when the president tweets? Is that policy or is it not policy? And how do we handle this? And this is playing out in real time now, 6 months later, as people try to figure out, you know, is what the president says, even though in this case it appears that he misconstrued what the mayor of London had said, is that our policy? And if so, do we not express solidarity with the mayor of London as he grapples with this attack? It's immensely difficult for the career professionals nowadays to figure out what to do and say.
Arshad, is this the type of incident that you may have seen before with new presidents who might not understand how sensitive each word is that falls from their lips, or in this case, a Twitter account?
I think there's a learning curve for everybody. There's certainly a learning curve for presidents. There's also a learning curve for secretaries of state. I'll give you an example. When former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to China on her first trip as the United States top diplomat, she made a statement to us that were the reporters traveling with her to the effect that we can't let issues like human rights with the Chinese get in the way of cooperating with them on the huge global issues like climate change and like the global financial crisis. You might think that if you're the U.S. Secretary of State. In fact, you probably do, but you don't say it out loud because you don't ever want to be seen as giving a pass to China or any other country to not respect human rights. So there's always a learning curve. I think here the learning curve is maybe steeper for President Trump because he, unlike most presidents of modern times, had not been a politician or a military officer before he came to this job. And so it may be taking him longer to learn the rules of the road on how you talk about these things. On the other hand, it could be that he's not really interested in the niceties here, and he's going to say what he thinks, and he's going to call a spade, and that the career diplomats and civil servants are just going to have to get in line with that or go. Early in the administration, the White House spokesman, I think when he was asked about the letter of protest against the initial travel ban, said something to the effect of they can get with the program or they can leave. And that was kind of chilling for a lot of people, but it may be that that's the kind of unsavory choice they feel. You know, either you do as the president asks, or if you feel that you can't, you make the decision that Mr. Rank did in Beijing, and you retire.
Arshad, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Arshad Mohammed is Reuters diplomatic correspondent. He was with us to look at tensions between diplomatic officials and the White House.
In the early part of last year, an infectious outbreak of a strain of the Elizabethkingia bacteria sickened more than 60 people and was fatal for 18 Wisconsin residents.
Well, Illinois and Michigan also had some reported infections. Wisconsin was the hardest hit. Because of that, international interest grew and many scientists worked together to try to figure out what was happening in the state.
Scott Gordon joins us now. He's the associate editor of WisContext. He just published a piece about the effort to understand the Elizabethkingia outbreak. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, take us out to this outbreak. It was a surprise, kind of out of nowhere. Remind us what happened.
Well, usually Elizabethkingia infects, you know, a handful of people every year in each state. And it's very unusual to have an outbreak of this scale. And when one of these genus of bacteria cause an outbreak, it's usually something that is kind of tied to a single, hospital facility or medical facility where, you know, all of the patients would have been kind of physically exposed to a common source of the bacteria. In this case, it was spread out around 12 counties in Wisconsin. And so there wasn't quite that same common tie. So as a consequence, it's been very hard for health officials to figure out exactly how this particular strain spread, and they still haven't got a clear answer on that.
And who was most at risk from this outbreak?
Basically, this genus of bacteria is really common. It's out there in soil and water. It doesn't infect a lot of people. But if you have a weakened immune system, then it kind of opportunistically can infect you. So people who are elderly, infants, people who are already battling a serious illness or, you know, have some other kind of condition that, weakens their immune defenses, those are the people that are most at risk, really.
And if we went back 2 years in time and talked to a public health official before this outbreak, Elizabethkingia would not have been really on the radar, wouldn't have been on the top list of what's keeping him awake at night.
Yeah, not really. There's certainly stuff out there in the medical literature about Elizabethkingia outbreaks, but, you know, one public health researcher said to me just this week, this isn't something that was really on our radar until this happened.
So now the CDC reached out. They thought, okay, what can we learn about this? They did something unusual to try to get researchers on board. What did they do?
Basically, they took all this genomic data from organisms, sampled from various patients in Wisconsin, and put it out there online for people to grab. And, they spread the word about it through Twitter. And, researchers from around the world, within 24 hours or so started kind of taking advantage of that and comparing this, genetic information with what they knew, which I think was helpful because there's been so little research on this pathogen, and what information is out there is spread around quite a bit.
Now, this isn't exactly, I use the word crowdsourcing when I talked to you earlier. It isn't exactly that because, I wouldn't be researching this at home, for example. But it's kind of unusual to say, hey, anybody who could research this, here's all our info. What can you make of it?
Right. And I think the speed of it was a really unusual thing because usually this information would get out there, but maybe it's just kind of a slower pace.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about the Elizabeth Kingia outbreak, kind of came out of nowhere, mostly here in Wisconsin, led to fatalities and a lot of people infected by this bacteria that doesn't usually affect that many people. So, Scott, you've got this CDC posting of the genome of this strain of the Elizabeth Kingia virus. We've got researchers around the world and here, I'm guessing, in Wisconsin looking at it. What kind of things did they learn from breaking this down?
Well, they published a paper in Nature recently, and it is a kind of a truly international effort. There's people from Wisconsin, as you said, but also people from the University of Melbourne in Australia, people from Institut Pasteur in Paris. And essentially what they found is that this strain has some really distinctive genetic mutations and that there's a lot of genetic mutation within this strain. So they've kind of figured out that Elizabeth Kingia bacteria mutate a little bit more often than a lot of others.
And so this one, if they compare the Elizabeth Kingia that caused this outbreak to the stuff we've had around beforehand, this one does look distinctive and different.
Yes, and that's helpful in that it helps people understand that they really have an outbreak on their hands as opposed to, scattered cases here and there, and that there's likely some kind of linkage between all these different cases.
Is there any thought that, okay, these mutations may have made this disease more infectious and maybe more deadly?
That could well be. The study really doesn't set out to establish that. There's a possibility that it could have made the bacteria more virulent or made the bacteria more resistant to people's immune defenses. They haven't quite figured that out yet, but that could have had something to do with it, for sure.
And is that hoped to be maybe a next step of research, maybe not even for these same researchers, to say, okay, we see these differences, what do they mean?
Sure. And I think another step that people really want to see come out of this is just a broader gathering of genetic data on rare pathogens so that when there's a surprising outbreak, when a pathogen like this, has an impact on a scale that people weren't expecting, researchers will have a lot more information to draw on in order to figure out what's going on.
Right. Sometime in the next 2 years, we might have an outbreak of not Elizabeth Kingia, but something else that's not on our radar. Is this a hope that this might be a model for how to quickly research these new emerging diseases?
Well, I'm not sure if people are using it as a model or not, but I know people that I talked with at the CDC and, at places like the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene were excited about this approach and, definitely were happy with what it enabled them to do.
And we had this big outbreak, again, a little over a year ago. What's been up with Elizabeth Kingia? Have we seen cases since that outbreak?
Yeah, there have been a few cases since the outbreak kind of subsided, and they haven't been of the outbreak strain.
So it's the stuff we had seen back in the past, kind of background noise.
Yeah, it's a little closer to normal obviously it matters that these people are getting sick, but it's a lot closer to the normal situation where there's a scattering of cases every year.
Now, I think bacteria, and I think, okay, no big deal, antibiotics should help us with that. But looking at this particular disease, that is easier said than done.
Right. It's resistant to many common antibiotics, and there's kind of a few specific ones that are known to be effective against it. And kind of in the midst of the outbreak, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services put some guidelines out about, you know, what kinds of drugs doctors should try and just how they should kind of try to calibrate it to specific patients. And they felt that once they got that out there, people had a little bit better luck, you know, beating the thing and surviving.
Now, here in Wisconsin, we have this research in Nature that you mentioned. I assume, I mean, obviously there are other diseases to worry about, but I assume Wisconsin health officials haven't dusted off their hands and closed the chapter on Elizabeth King yet. They're still wanting to learn more.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, we still haven't exactly, the state, I should say, hasn't exactly figured out where this came from. You know, in other studies of Elizabeth King outbreaks in the medical literature, there's, you know, been some kind of conclusion of, you know, that this was on a faucet that a bunch of people were exposed to or something like that. But here we still really don't quite know.
So the genome part solved part of the mystery. It identified that this is a different mutant strain. It didn't solve all of the mystery.
That's right. Or it might help with the remaining pieces, but hard to say.
Well, Scott, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Scott Gordon, associate editor for WisContext. He joined us to talk about why the Elizabeth Kingia outbreak in Wisconsin last week was different than the usual, why it was deadly, some recent research on the genetics behind this. You can read his research, by the way. Check it out over at wiscontext.org.
President Trump announced his plan yesterday for overhauling the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA. That's the agency responsible for all aspects of civilian aviation. Here's a clip from President Trump announcing that plan.
We're proposing reduced wait times, increased route efficiency, and far fewer delays. Our plan will get you where you need to go more quickly, more reliably, more affordably, and yes, for the first time in a long time, on time. We will launch this air travel revolution by modernizing the outdated system of air traffic control. It's about time.
Part of the president's plan includes privatizing the agency's air traffic controllers. Ashley Nunes joins us now to talk about what this would all mean. He studies regulatory policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's a contributor to Forbes and has written for the Globe and Mail, NPR, and Scientific American. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think a lot of people hear privatizing air traffic controllers and think, okay, what does that mean? How would it work? So give us the basics. What is the president proposing here?
Well, the proposal itself isn't entirely new. Essentially, what the president is proposing is shifting about 30,000 employees from the Federal Aviation Administration over to a private, non-profit organization. And that particular organization would be tasked with providing and managing air traffic services in the United States.
And why would that be better? He's making the case that this would improve air traffic control. It would lower wait times, make things more efficient. Connect the dots for us.
Sure. So the FAA is a federal agency, and there have over the years been a number of criticisms leveled at the agency. One of which is the fact that not only does the FAA provide air traffic services, but it also provides the safety oversight for those services. So essentially what you have is an organization that is not only providing a service, but it is also regulating the service itself. And many people charge that creates an inherent conflict of interest. A more pressing matter for the FAA is the fact that because it is largely seen as being a government bureaucracy, it makes it very, very difficult for the organization to move in a timely manner when it comes to adopting particularly cutting-edge technology that can benefit the taxpayer. A great example of this is radar. So, you know, when you look at airplanes in the United States today, air traffic controllers track these airplanes using World War II radar. There are newer systems available. If you think about your iPhone, for example, in fact, all smartphones, you have GPS on these phones. And that would be a far more accurate way of tracking airplanes, satellite-based systems. But unfortunately, what has happened over the years is that, and this is the charge that critics level at the agency, that government bureaucracy just makes it very difficult to acquire these types of technologies. And very often, by the time the technology has been acquired, the technology itself is obsolete.
Some people who are objecting to this change point out that air travel, compared to, you know, a few decades ago, going back to the 70s especially, is really, really safe by comparison. Crashes are very rare, things that were fairly common occurrences not all that long ago.
Sure, of course. I mean, look, you know, whenever we talk about something as important as air traffic control and the aviation system as a whole, the first word that comes to the flying public's mind, at least, is safety. But safety has become a bit of a red herring, in my view at least, both from Republicans as well as Democrats. You know, the White House says that private governance will make flying safer. In fact, all Republicans, many Republicans say that. And the Democrats say, as you correctly note, flying is as safe as it's ever been. Having said that, it's important to remember that the reason why the number of fatal crashes has dropped, at least in the United States and, in fact, most developed economies, has little to do with the governance structure itself. It has nothing to do with the fact that it's a government organization versus a private entity. Rather, it has everything to do with the fact that airplanes today are manufactured very differently compared to what they were in decades prior. Right? So, for example, the likelihood of an engine failing in flight is significantly lower today than it was 20 or 30 years ago. That's what I would say. I would say this is not really a safety concern. Because the improvements in safety that we see are the result of technological advances.
Ashley Nunes is with us from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, talking about President Trump's call to, in effect, privatize air traffic control in the United States. This is something that would need to go through Congress still. Ashley, looking at this plan, who would be in charge of this nonprofit entity then that would control air traffic control?
Well, the proposed structure is essentially that you would have 13 members, a governing board. Two of those positions would go to airlines, two would go to union representatives. You have one for general aviation. You have four individuals who would be elected by a board. You would have the Secretary of Transport, for example. So there are a number of sort of, you know, high-level stakeholders that would be represented at the table, and they essentially would determine how the operation is run with some degree of regulatory oversight.
And let's talk about money for this. One reason people cite for making this change is that this is currently air traffic control is currently paid for in large part by user fees from airline users, but that can be gummed up by the annual appropriations process or breakdown of that process in Congress. How would this new system be funded then?
Well, that's exactly correct. I mean, for the longest time, it has been the case that even though the FAA is funded primarily by user fees, you know, things on, fees on things like domestic tickets and jet fuel, it's Congress that determines, that essentially appropriates the funds. And what has happened over the years is with things like, the budget, the government shutdown, for example, and sequestration, it has really hampered the agency's ability to do long-term planning because the agency isn't necessarily aware of how much money it's going to get the following year and 3 years and 5 years down the road. In an organization like this, in a private corporation, you would have airlines that are paying these fees directly to the corporation, and then the corporation would be free to use those funds as they wish. So you, essentially what you are doing is you're cutting out the middleman.
We're talking to Ashley Nunes now from MIT about the news that President Trump wants to privatize air traffic control.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this plan? What kind of impact do you think this will have on airline customers? Do you think this will be good for air travel? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now with Ashley Nunes of MIT about President Trump's plan to privatize air traffic control.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how this would work and what it would mean? What is your reaction to this idea? Do you work in the airline industry for an airline itself, or maybe you're an air traffic controller? Love to hear your perspective on the suggestion. Do we need this change? Do we need technological changes in how we track those planes in the sky? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Ashley, I wanted to ask, you know, there are people out there who are air traffic controllers. They're working at the airports today under this plan. Are the same people going to be doing this job? Does that change at all?
It does not change. No, not at all. I mean, part of the reason why you have seen in recent months at least tepid support for many air traffic controllers for the plan is that they have been able to get guarantees from lawmakers, at least provisional guarantees, that things like pensions and job security will not be affected by the plan.
I've seen some criticism of this idea from people in aviation but not connected to the big airlines. So people with, say, a private plane, for example, thinking that, okay, this new agency will prioritize the big guys, basically the big airline industry, and they would be excluded. Is there a reason for that concern?
I would offer a bit of a correction to that statement. It is not the case that they would be excluded. Rather, it is the case that they could potentially see their fees go up for using the service. I mean, essentially what the transference from a government to a private entity does is it's leveling to users of the system. It's charging people for the service that they use. And this is something that the corporate jet lobby and general aviation pilots are quite worried about. Essentially, they're worried that their fees are going to go up as a result of moving over to a corporate entity when it comes to the provision of air traffic services.
And another concern that's been out there, apart from this whole change, is smaller city, smaller town airports. Many have closed here in Wisconsin, for example, over the years. Would this changeover mean anything for those smaller market airports?
Well, I think that, it's a great question, and the answer to that is unknown at this time. Having said that, there certainly is reason to worry, primarily because one of the things that has happened as a result of increased fuel volatility, so in the market, coupled with the fact that many airlines have merged, we only have three or four large U.S. carriers, is that airlines have decided to concentrate where they deploy their airplanes on revenue-rich markets. Major cities, middle to large cities, and smaller markets generally don't make that much money for airlines. It's having to do with the types of airplanes that fly into these locations. In fact, depending on how you crunch the numbers, at least one study has found that the types of airplanes that fly into smaller markets can be up to 60% less fuel efficient to fly. And this is a big deal for airlines because, fuel often tends to be their highest operating expense. So, yes, I mean, I think that small airports are certainly worried because essentially what they might lose is the political capital to be able to preserve service at their facilities.
We got a call from Eric in Janesville who couldn't stay on the line. Eric's wondering, is this move supposed to save money? If so, how? So is this revenue neutral, more or less expensive, Ashley?
Well, the way the proposal is currently being sold is that it will be revenue neutral. In fact, over the long run, it's essentially designed to make money for the private corporation itself. Now, the Trump administration has billed this as being essentially taking 30,000 odd employees off the government payroll at no charge. There are people who dispute that claim, how it pans out remains to be seen.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Buck on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Buck, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Thanks for the show, and thanks for your guest this afternoon. This is a great topic. Just a few concerns. Since 9/11, we've seen some very significant changes in the airline industry in general, and I think we can all agree that we are somewhat safer when we fly today. Is this whole thing, in your opinion, sir, is this really a solution in search of a problem? Is this something that really needs to be addressed? Or is this an attempt, in your opinion, on the part of President Trump, who really hasn't had any victories since he's been in office, to, give the American public and the voters something that he can call a success.
Buck, thanks for the call. Ashley, a solution, search of a problem. Is this something we really need to be tackling?
Well, I think that, I would not characterize it that way. I think that many Democrats certainly have. Having said that, it's important to remember that privatization is hardly, has hardly been pushed by the Trump administration per se. The idea itself of privatizing air traffic control goes back some 30 years, back when Ronald Reagan was president. And at that time, his commission on privatization identified air traffic control as being an industry that was essentially ripe for outsourcing. I do not believe it is a problem in search of a problem. I think that there are very legitimate reasons to look for an alternative form of governance, preferably a model that delivers maximum value to the people who are actually paying for the service.
Buck, thanks for that call. Go next to Philip in Eagle River. Philip, hi.
Yes. As a former private pilot, I too am concerned about the small airports. But more important, I would like to go back to the 60s when Kennedy's promise was fulfilled by an organization between the government and private industry. I believe it's essential that the personnel be civil service, because when profit rules, safety is in danger.
Philip, thanks for that call. So Philip thinking, Ashley, that we want these air traffic controllers to be civil servants if they are partly, at least, under the control of this board, which is partly run by the airline industry and other people with a stake in it. Maybe that's a temptation to cut corners, could put safety at risk.
Well, I don't know if I quite see it that way. I would argue that air traffic controllers are professionals, and they have an interest in making sure the skies are safe, regardless of whether or not they are private or government employees. That's just as true in the United States as it is in Canada, that has privatized, in New Zealand, in the United Kingdom, etc.
Thanks for the call, Philip. As we start to wrap up, Ashley, the president signed basically a memo, but this all goes to Congress, and a lot can happen there. What are you looking for as this goes into the political realm? What are you expecting to see?
Well, it's a very good question as to whether or not this will get the level of backing it requires in order to make it through. Already, we have seen significant opposition from various corners. We discussed small airports earlier, and it really does remain to be seen. This particular legislation did not even get on the House floor last year because there was so much opposition to it. Things have changed just a little bit. We'll see.
Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Ashley Nunes. He studies regulatory policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He joined us to talk about the news that President Trump wants to privatize air traffic control, put it under the control of a nonprofit board instead of, as it currently is, under the Federal Aviation Administration. You can find a link to a piece that Ashley wrote and share your thoughts on the topic. Just head over and do that on the Central Time Facebook page.
Across Wisconsin, there are state and federal efforts to reduce industrial pollution in waterways. In some cases, they have brought back aquatic life. In Green Bay, it could mean bringing back a city beach that's been closed since the 1940s. Patty Murray has another installment of our series, State of Change.
The Fox River runs into the Bay of Green Bay. The EPA has been dredging PCBs from its sediment as part of the Superfund program. That could end up putting the beach back into Bay Beach.
I feel like it's really good for the community. If there wasn't a beach, it would be really bad.
It would just be a bay with no beach.
Yeah.
That's no fun.
Yeah.
That's 5.5-year-old Wren Cast. She was visiting the park on opening day in May. Her father, DJ, and mother, Jenna, agreed with her.
So if they can clean it up and make Bay Beach an actual beach to swim in as well, I think that's only better for the community.
Yeah. Do you think you'd bring your family here more often if there was an actual beach?
I think so. I mean, we try to go to beaches, but it's hard to find any that are nearby. So if there was one here that was usable, that would definitely be a bonus.
Bay Beach is a city park that has a variety of amusement rides, including the Zippin' Peepin' roller coaster. The beach permanently closed around 1945, according to Mary Jane Herber, a historian with the Brown County Library. She believes part of what made it a good swimming beach was its depth.
It's very, very shallow. You can, and there's certain parts of the bay that you can walk out for, I don't know, a tenth of a mile or more.
But those shallow waters kept contaminants close to shore. Locals even coined a term for it.
Oh, I think they called it the itch, you know, that there would be something in the water that would give people some kind of a rash.
In French, Green Bay is La Baie Verte and partly takes its name from algae. Along with industrial and human or bird waste, algae would periodically close the beach over the years. Then it shut down for good.
That was closed for water pollution way back when.
Donnelly Dinsmore is the DNR's beach coordinator. She says the closure of Bay Beach was partly due to paper mills.
Discharges from industry were going directly into the water.
Dinsmore says temporary closures on the state's coastal beaches are usually caused by algae or E. coli.
These are naturally occurring bacteria, and so what we're monitoring is when does the level rise to the level that we think that we should advise people to exercise more caution.
The city of Green Bay is doing a feasibility study on reopening the beach. The city would also have to get permits from the EPA and DNR, so any swimming is still several years off. Jason Arnoldy has worked at the park for 22 years and is now its manager. In that time, he's seen nature rebound.
We noticed a lot of return of certain wildlife, pelicans, stuff like that, and so the water is getting a lot cleaner. We still have to do some more tests and see exactly where we're at, but it's looking a lot better.
If and when a beach opens, Arnoldy says it could do wonders for attendance.
I think in general in Green Bay, since the closest beach is about 30 miles away, it means a lot to the community to have something like that back in the Green Bay area. Obviously for us, we see a lot of a lot more people out here, people in just out here to enjoy the beach itself versus just going on rides.
Meanwhile, dredging continues on the river. People continue to ride the rides, and what was once the sandy beach sits vacant and covered in rocks. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.